This is Book Public from Texas Public Radio. I'm Yvette Benavides. On this episode, I speak to Peter Orner about his latest novel, The Gossip Columnist's Daughter. Peter Orner, yes, that Peter Orner. If you listen to TPR's other literary podcast, The Lonely Voice with Peter Orner, you know the name, the voice, the tremendous insights on stories that he shares on each episode. We've benefited from his tremendous experience as an acclaimed author of 7 books. His latest is the novel, The Gossip Columnist's Daughter, and it is as compelling as the title implies. There is a gossip columnist, and there is his daughter. But let me start here instead. Jed Rosenthal. He's a writer and a professor who lives in Chicago. He hasn't published a book in over 10 years. He and his partner Hannah are on the outs. She leaves him and takes their little daughter with her. He's having a very tough time of things. When he visits his grandmother Babs in a nursing home, an often repeated story from family lore takes hold. He's reminded that Babs and her husband Lou were best friends with another couple, Essie and Irv Kupcinet. Irv was a columnist. No, he was. There was a real Irv Kupcinet, who was a gossip columnist in Chicago, and his influence was far-reaching. He had a wife named Essie. They had 2 children, including a daughter named Karen. Karen was found dead in her West Hollywood apartment in November of 1963, just days after the assassination of President Kennedy. Jed is dealing with his own issues, but the questions and the mysteries about Karen consume his life. As he enters the worlds of the past to get closer to the mystery, there are more questions to figure out and more mysteries to resolve. This is a book about a lot of different kinds of love. There's history, popular culture, and true crime here. This is a Chicago story, and all that you might expect from a truly great Chicago story. It's about a Hollywood that was as fickle in the early 1960s as it is today. This is a story about time, memory, loneliness, and love. Oh, and there's a cat, too. I spoke to Peter Orner about his novel, The Gossip Columnist's Daughter. You know, usually I prepare a lot of questions and I bring a lot of notes into the studio and like 20 questions typed out, but I don't have anything.
It's good.
I just have the book. So normally on Book Public, as you know, I start out by asking the author just to tell us a little bit about the book, just a little bit for context, and then we can go from there. Is that a terrible question?
No, of course not. I mean, a little bit about the book. The book is, it's just like weird if I'm self-conscious telling you about it, you know. The book is about the death of a young woman, an actor in Hollywood in November of 1963. The death occurred a week after the Kennedy assassination. So the book is about, I have so many different answers to this. That's kind of my problem. I think the book is about the death of friendship. I mean, ultimately, I think, you know, and how, to my mind, there's not enough stories about this incredibly painful and common phenomena, which is when friendships end and deep friendships, you know, which are obviously a form of love, which are love. I think this book ultimately is about that. It's about many other things. It's about Chicago, and it's about the 60s and about the world of a gossip columnist. And but ultimately, it comes down to it's about the end of a friendship, really 2 friendships, a friendship between couples, which I find an especially interesting phenomena.
There's a lot here to unpack. But yeah, at the center of this is a friendship story or friendship stories. But really a key friendship story is the one that readers will find between Babs and Essie. But the idea of the gossip columnist's daughter from the title, it's so intriguing, the title itself. And the gossip columnist was a real figure. And the gossip columnist's daughter, also a real person. And so it's just a very interesting sort of hub in the story from which all other aspects of the story sort of spin off, including our narrator. But you're right. I mean, this is an almost, 500-page book. There's a lot going on. But at the heart of it is, it's really about love. It's really about this kind of love. But the gossip columnist is Irv Kupcinet. Can you talk about him a little bit?
Irv Kupcinet, if you're from Chicago and if you're of a certain age, you know the name. And even if you never read a single word of his, you probably know the name. He's one of those names in Chicago that just endures even to this day. But Irv Kupcinet was a columnist, newspaper columnist for the ultimately the Chicago Sun-Times, and he was the society guy. You know, he was the man about town, a gossip columnist, and he was ubiquitous for upwards of like 40 years. I mean, starting in the 50s, all the way really to 2000, almost 50 years, let's say, that he was a force in Chicago. Not only was he a force in Chicago, but he was a force nationally. He was a syndicated columnist, and he knew everybody. He was tight with Bob Hope. He was tight with Sinatra. He was tight with Bing Crosby, Elizabeth Taylor. He was the guy. And at a certain time in our history, I guess, in order to make it big in the United States, you had to go through Chicago. You had to make it in Chicago. And in order to make it in Chicago, the line always was, you had to go through Irv Kupcinet. And back in the day when people didn't fly across the country, but rather take the trains, people would, and this was like in the 50s and even the 40s, stars, Hollywood stars would take the train and they would stop, you know, if they were going coast to coast, they would stop in Chicago and they would spend a few hours with Irv Kupcinet, and they would feature in his column, and that would help their careers. And this went on for many, many, many years. He was the guy that would put your name in bold type.
So he was like the ultimate influencer, right? Like not necessarily a star maker, but certainly somebody that a star or an up-and-coming star would want to talk to and would want to land in that column, I guess.
Yeah, an influencer is a really great way to put it. I mean, he was the ultimate influencer. And at a certain point, I mean, he would, you know, just ask him, he would tell you he was the guy. He was the most important one. There were others, you know,
sure.
Herb Cain in San Francisco. And then the bigger, even bigger name than Irv Kupcinet would have been Walter Winchell. But Kup was big. He was big. And he was in movies. He would be have cameos in films. You know, he hobnobbed. His job was to hobnob, you know. And so that's what he did. And he did it. Few people, I think, hobnobbed as well as Irv Kupcinet.
And he had a TV show, right, which I found very interesting, too. People need to read about this TV show in this novel. It's amazing.
I'll just say the show was fun to research. And it was also fun to remember, because I do remember it. It was called At Random, and it was on very late at night in Chicago, in my day on public TV, but it went in its heyday. It was ABC, CBS, NBC, probably all the networks. Kup was at some point on, but you'd watch it at midnight, and it would be a group of people, a talk show, but a group of, you know, like four or five stars. You know, you'd have Lucille Ball, you'd have Sammy Davis, you'd have maybe a professor of something, you'd have an expert on environmental issues. I mean, Kup was interesting. He was sort of ahead of his time in some ways on civil rights. He was actually quite ahead in his way. So at random, they would talk about, he would just, you know, he'd make mention a topic and they would just sort of ramble about it. They'd be smoking. And the show at one point had no end time, literally. It would just be as long as they could keep a conversation going, the show would be on. It was pretty hilarious. And I was a kid, and I didn't really understand what they were talking about, but I knew it was. I knew there was something to it. I knew it was interesting in some way.
So Irv Kupcinet's daughter is the gossip columnist's daughter of the title. So Karen, also known as Cookie, can you talk about her and what she is all about in this book?
Irv Kupcinet had a daughter, and he had a son too, and a very successful son. He went to Hollywood. He was a producer. But Karen, in high school, started acting and got really into it, and ended up eventually, after a couple years of college, going out to Hollywood. And you know, she'd done a lot of theater productions in Chicago, and so, you know, she was a working actress. Karen Kupcinet was a kid who grew up in a family surrounded by movie stars who would come and be, in her house all the time. And of course, she got into it. She got into theater and acting, and eventually she ends up in Hollywood very young at 21, and she starts a career as an actress. And she has some successes. She's on television in a number of guest spots: Perry Mason, Red Skelton Show, Donna Reed Show, Mrs. G Goes to College, all kinds of shows. She also landed a role in a Jerry Lewis movie called Ladies' Man, which is a hilariously bad movie about an all-women hotel that the Jerry Lewis character, moves in as the only guy, and he's the handyman of the hotel, and uproarious comedy ensues. And Karen Cupsinet was in that movie in a very small role, so she had been in a film, and she was working, and she was good. She was a talented actress. She was also very connected. Her father knew everybody, so that's complicated. And even in the news coverage of her before her death, there was often mention of her famous father and how that added sort of a boost to her career, but also made people believe that she didn't have talent. She was just, she was just a nepo kid, right? And that was a hard thing for her to deal with. And I've thought a lot about her as a character and what she might have been like as a person. She died 5 or 6 years before I was born, but I'd heard a lot about her growing up, and the reason I had heard that is because she died under mysterious circumstances, a week after the Kennedy assassination in November of 1963. The death had a long story to it, and it continues to this very day. If you look at true crime stuff on the internet, you will see Karen Cupsinet's name come up. People continue to be fascinated by her story.
All those things really happened, but in the novel, in this work of fiction, we have the character of Jed Rosenthal telling us the story, and within the story, trying to figure out not just what happened back there in the years before he was born, what happened back there, but also is very curious about other things that happened after Cookie's death, after Karen's death. And one of the things that happened was that Jed's grandmother, grandparents, who were good friends with Irv and Essie, his wife, Irv and Essie Cupsinet, Lou and Babs Rosenthal, best friends, couples who are best friends, right? Something happens. Something happens at a moment in time when friends need each other the most, when something so egregiously horrific happens, like the death of Karen. So, I mean, just on its face, that's compelling, except that Jed was around these people. I mean, Jed was in Irv's column, right? Jed was around these people and really wants to understand not just the mystery of what happened to Cookie, to Karen, but the mystery of what happened between these best friends. And all of this is happening to Jed while he's trying to figure out his own life, his own love life, his own professional life, his writing career, his being a father. So there's so much going on with Jed, but it's really just genius how the story starts to unfold, or begins, really, the book begins before Jed is even born. But Jed is telling us the story, and we're just hooked by all these mysteries, especially the mystery of Karen early on. But then at a certain point, we're hooked, really, to the mystery of Jed. There's so much. That it's a historical fiction. It's noir. It's true crime, as you said. It's a love story. It's a friendship story, which is a very compelling love story in itself, too. There's popular culture elements in here. Even as you ticked off the names of the celebrities that were in Irv's column, I was thinking, someone very young might not know these names, somebody reading this book, but that's what Google is for. That's what the internet is for. But I think for a lot of readers, it will be so incredibly enjoyable to have this catalog of these people and this particular moment in time in one book. That's a lot too, but there's just so much to say. But I wonder if from all of that, if you can talk about Jed.
That's great. No, thank you, Ben. I mean, it's incredibly generous and kind. And I should say that just in terms of the names, and I love to think about the names because in a lot of ways, Cups Column, which is what it was called, Cups Column, was built on names. I mean, names. And I was just thinking about one of the, kind of the things I was always had the back in my mind while I was working on this was just how important names were and are, right? And how sort of certain names get lodged, right? And so, you know, Cup wrote books. He wrote a couple of memoirs. And on one of the memoirs, on the back of the memoirs, it starts out, it's literally a wall of names. So it starts with Michael Jackson and Princess Di, and then it goes alphabetical: Muhammad Ali, Woody Allen, Anne Margaret, Richard Attenborough, Lauren Bacall, Burt Bacharach, Joan Baez, Warren Beatty, and it goes on and on and on. And I was just thinking, like, just to be in a world surrounded by names, which to a certain extent we all are all the time, you know. And I thought he kind of captured that notion. And Jed, my character, becomes like as even more obsessed than I am about all of this. And he thinks, probably erroneously, that by digging into the past, by trying to understand what happened between the Kupcinets and the Rosenthals, the severance, the break, the cataclysm that precipitated the end of their friendship, which was the death of one of the couple's daughters. I was just thinking about what happens in the aftermath of something like that and what happens to even our closest friendships. And that was what Jed believes, that if he can kind of figure that out or at least kind of explore it, he'll start to understand why his own life has gone so south with his marriage, his partnership, and his he's got a young kid, and he lives about a mile and a half away from Hannah and the kid.
And there's Rudy.
Yeah, and he has one friend in the world, and that's his cat. And I was thinking, I've been asked about this lately a little bit, and it, you know, when you're depressed, you have friends. Your friends are around, and you know they're there, but sometimes you don't want to deal with them, and. I don't know. I found in my own life as I turned to my pets, you know, as the go-tos. And so Jed, at one point, he tells himself, he's like, he knows his friends are around and his friends have reached out. He just doesn't have the bandwidth for him right now, but he does talk to his cat. And like most cats, the cat's so not interested in Jed and Jed's problems.
Oh, but the cat in this book. Anyway, everybody must read this book for no other reason, for the dialogue between Jed and Rudy. But you say something very interesting. So like this kind of obsessiveness that Jed has with the mystery of Karen, what competes with that also, obviously, is really the mystery of what caused the demise of the friendship. But as you say, it's like he's really grappling with a lot of other deep, deep questions. I mean, and there are questions that emerge here that he doesn't even ask or prompt us to, that we're all thinking about. That's one of the other things I love about this novel, is the questions that pop up for me that comes just from reading the book. But anyway, that aside, but his obsessiveness, his research, I mean, he even traveled to Hollywood. One of the other characters in the book compares him to the Unabomber because he has just like this wall of photos and notes, and he is just really consumed with this idea that's really about not just one mystery, not just one question to try to answer, but so many other things at once. So I just love the multidimensionality of this, and I can burrow into one or another thing as I move through the book over multiple readings, but even in just one reading. It's just something that, you know, quite genius. Then there's another layer of all of this. I mentioned the research. I know you did painstaking research and then research that just sort of exists because of your family. So some of this is based on your own grandparents. This is not necessarily, we're not going to call this a true story, obviously. People throw around the words like autofiction or metafiction and this and that, but this is a work of fiction. But there are characters here who are inspired by real characters in your life.
Fiction's been around a long time. What does it need suddenly, this little word ahead of it, when
Let me ask it this way. Did you have a sailor suit?
I did have a sailor suit.
Okay.
I did. My whole family would verify the truth of that. My father was, I don't know if there's a word for this, but like a naviophile, you know? he really just like all naval things. In fact, there's a story that I've written in a different book about my parents' honeymoon. My mom and dad were in a bar in Miami, and there was an altercation between a naval officer in a gleaming, in my imagination, white suit with like those things on the shoulders, you know? And my dad just like, you know, it's just like that was like his ultimate, his God. And there was this guy got into a fight, and my dad, who's not a very big guy, intervened on behalf of the officer. And anyway, he was just like, he loved, and my grandfather was in the Navy, which adds a complication because they had a kind of a strained relationship, but he must have had respect for his own father, in at least in part. Where am I going with this? My dad did dress me up in a sailor suit as my dress-up clothes for us, until like John Kennedy kind of thing, until a certain age when I was like, no fucking way, are we doing this anymore? But yes, I did have a sailor suit. I think there's photographs somewhere.
There are real elements, true life elements, that you were able to weave into the story, because the mystery of the friendship between Irvin Essie and Llewyn Babbs was inspired by a real rift that occurred in the friendship between Irvin Essie and your own grandparents somewhere in there.
But I mean, that's the kind of the you know, tiny little pin of foundation on which the story was sort of built, and again, no big deal. Like, it wasn't, and Jed talks about this a lot in the book, like, it isn't that big a deal to be former friends with a famous gossip columnist. And yet, when I was growing up, it was always in the back of our minds, our family used to be friends with the Kupcinets, as if that was some kind of big deal.
I think for a young person, that's okay. You know.
Yeah, well, you got to hang your hat on something. You know what I mean? Like, it's just like, you know, brushes with fame. I think people love them, you know, and this was a small brush with fame. And I should say that I met Cup a few times through my dad, who stayed in touch with him over the years. And also because I was a stringer, a sports stringer for the Chicago Sun-Times. So I would sometimes see him in the halls, and he was always very kind. And I should say that even though, as a fictional character, I sort of have some fun with Cup, and also, you know, he was a figure of certain kind of lack of seriousness, I think, given what he did for a living. But I, as a character, and also as just, you know, the memory of a person, I really tried to, as I do with any of my characters, I fall in love with them to a certain extent. And it doesn't mean I'm going to sugarcoat who they are in my mind. Cup with somebody who lived through a lot of very, very hard things. And that's much of the book is about that.
Jed was fascinated, and not so much by the celebrity of it or maybe that, but there's just something about Irv that seems so incredibly entrepreneurial or creative or industrious or something. I don't know how this guy ever sleep?
He's, I mean, six columns a week, he didn't sleep at all. It's certain, his height of his fame, you know, like six columns a week, and, you know, a little bit later, this TV show on top of that. And also, in order to do his job, he had to be a man about town. He had to be out every night.
Yeah.
So I was just like, I can barely get out once a month. Right. And so, I was sort of amazed by the level of energy. You know, it took a lot of work. You know, I say in the book, it took a lot of work to be so trivial. But, I want to emphasize the lot of work part there. It's a
Yeah.
lot of work. It's a lot of work.
That does come through, but I want to say one more thing about Jed and the people in his life. So, sort of the admiration or the awe that the reader can have with how absolutely productive Irv Kupcinet was. But then, that's all sort of driven by what Jed is allowing us to think about and see. And one of the things I love about Jed's perception of the world is how he also includes Solly. So there's this very interesting thing that's happening with the idea of celebrity or fame or a big Hollywood mystery. But then Jed is really also entranced by other simpler, purer, just as beautiful kinds of people and stories.
You never know what you're doing, right? And I still don't know. And I think one of the bigger falsehoods of like finishing a book and having it out there is then talking about it as if your intentions were really met and you really knew what you were doing, right? Questions about Sally, right?
Yeah.
Well, what I said about not knowing what I'm doing, could that like that's what I kind of mean to say.
You know what I think? I don't know. I feel like here's this book about all these big major things. And in a lot of the big major things, Solly is there. And, he's even at helping at the Thanksgiving dinner quietly in his own way. And Jed perceives this. Jed is such a noticer, he's so observant, of course. But the story about Solly, for me as a reader, is it's just another kind of love story that's in here. It's another mystery that's in this book, and it's a very quiet one. And I'm not going to say if you blink, you'll miss it, because that's not true at all, because Solly is quite present in this book, but in a very quiet way. And I just love this character who's very tall and big compared to the other men, and he carries a book around, and I don't know, there's so much about that character that I really love that's just different from what, these other worlds that we get to go into in this book. Then we get to go also into a little bit into Solly's world, and he is as enigmatic. And what I do know about him, I love.
He's a character that was really significant to me when I was working on this because he didn't have a place in this story, and yet he kept kind of not aggressively because he's not a very aggressive person, even though he was a did work for the great Chicago mobster Greasy Thumb Gusek as his right-hand man for many years. He wasn't an effusive guy. He in my mind, he just kept kind of like almost like quietly tiptoeing into a room. And for a big guy, that's not easy. And he just kept being in the story. And I like to think of him kind of almost like pulling me through, the 15 years that I was working on this. It was this quiet, almost peripheral character who acts as a sort of as a bodyguard for Cup when Cup and his friend Lou Rosenthal go into California to pick up Karen's body, getting in the weeds here. But he just kept appearing in my mind, and he kept kind of nudging his way back into the story. And so I appreciate that he's somebody I think of as being sort of the heart of the story, even though he's not the lead.
Another thing about this novel that I really appreciate, it's the way you write women. Even the way that you bring to us a real person, Essie, and bring Karen to us in such a sympathetic way. I mean, you really get into this idea of how potentially, probably hurt she was by this focus that the media, that Hollywood has on physical appearance and weight and all the rest. And, this idea that she was really good in plays. So obviously she had talent, but she had almost so much more to prove because she's Cup's daughter. And the way that, of course, that you write Babs at all stages of her life. I mean, we really see Babs at all stages of her life, even when Jed is just recalling something about her younger days and then on through in the nursing home. And of course, her during her friendship, the days of her friendship with Essie. And also the way that you, I mean, gosh, even the way that you write Hannah and Snook, the child. There's just a lot here about women, even Solly's wife, the way that you write women. So I don't know. I don't know what I'm trying to say about that, except that you write men also a certain way in this novel. And all of that is very, very, very interesting to me, too. But there's something about the way that you capture the darkness of a Karen Kupcinet in her loneliness and the way that you capture the friendship between Essie and Babs, that's so beautiful. It's not like they're, I don't know, that they're like Lucy and Ethel or something, you know. It's almost like in the quieter moments, especially after the death of Cookie, that I don't know how you did it, Peter, but that I can read the story of the grief. I can read the story of the abject sorrow that has befallen these couples, these people, these mothers. And I just know that story. Anyway, I don't know what I'm asking, but I'm saying a lot.
I mean, I appreciate it. I'm so grateful for that take. To me, there is a moment in the book where Jed's mother, who's also a character.
I love the mother so much, I have to say, too. Anyway, sorry to interrupt.
Fictional mother. The mother says something that, you know, and I'll tell you this because I'm talking to you, Yvette, but, you know, there are elements of things that happened, let's say. And you know, I remember something to the effect of talking to my own mother, who I hope doesn't listen to this, who, you know, asking about this old case that she was around for. I mean, she, you know, my mom moved to Chicago in the early 60s and knew Cookie Kupcinet, knew the Kupcinets. And, you know, I would just ask her just periodically while I was working on the book about those days and those times. And I remember saying something to the effect of, you know, keep your eye on the women, you know, that the story, as much as you might think it's about the men, it's about the women. I took that to heart as I was creating the fiction. And in terms of Cookie herself, I mean, in some ways she's almost like a, you know, a familiar story, right? Young girl goes to Hollywood, tries to make it big and ends up, you know, dead, right? How many of those stories are there? I tried to just think about the days, like the afternoons, you know, of when you're waiting for a call, you know, just the more kind of mundane factors that go into the day to day being in Los Angeles and trying to make it. And the complication in Cookie's case is, yeah, as you say, there was so much emphasis on physical appearance and she had issues with her weight and throughout her whole life. And I think to deal with that personally is enough, but imagine having to deal with the newspapers. Every single article about you is about how your weight fluctuates, you know, and that was the case with Cookie. There were constant. And here's where, you know, I don't know this for a fact, but I speculate that the amount of coverage of a young actress starting out, doing some TV guest spots, having a tiny role in a Jerry Lewis film, there was an inordinate amount of news coverage. Why? Because of her father, is my speculation. And I think that must have added an incredible amount of pressure on her. So add the normal story of somebody, you know, kind of going to Hollywood and trying to get discovered. Add the complication of you're already discovered because of who you are. Then you got to, as you said earlier, prove it. And I think that just must have been incredibly tough.
So, Peter, is there anything that, because I know you've been interviewed quite a bit and you've seen the reviews. And is there anything that just hasn't cropped up that you wish somebody would ask you about?
I mean, you've asked me about a lot of things that no one's asked me about, you know, especially in terms of just the Cookie character and the focus on Essie and Babs. So I appreciate that. I mean, like you said, there's a lot of moving parts to this, and I hope I can say this publicly, is that, you know, nobody helped me more on this book than you. And you know, successive readings of it and helping me at every step. So I want to thank you publicly for that, and also to say, like, you know, that your reading of it was as intense and as close as anybody's ever going to give this book. So yeah, thanks for that. As for, you know, you mentioned the cat. It's fun to talk about Rudy and Solly. You know, Solly again, because he's not like the sexiest character, and he doesn't really figure in the mystery of the death and what happened to Cookie, or what might have happened to Cookie, or what might not have happened to Cookie. No, the answer is your questions were beautiful. Thank you. This obsession that people have in Chicago with the mob, and I wanted to play with that trope too. You know, the kind of like wanting to kind of rub shoulders with, you know, with the bad guys. That was something that was part of Irv Kupson's personality, and he was connected to the mafia in some ways, especially through Sidney Korshak, who in his day was the most important lawyer in the country because of how much power he had as the mob sort of go-to between a legitimate business and in the underworld. But I wanted to sort of explore why we sort of want to be close to that. You know, we don't want to look at it very closely, but we want to kind of feel like we are in that world because it's exciting, right? And this is what got Cup tangled up in the JFK assassination and the rabbit holes that Jed goes down exploring this, because of Cup's connection to JFK and the mafia. That's what made his daughter's death suspect. And so that's what made it get caught up in the JFK conspiracy stuff that this day continues. And so part of the obsessive quality of the book was just getting wound up in that, that my narrator just gets, he just gets deeper and deeper into this spiraling connection and disconnection and conspiracy and nonsense, but also like, interesting, wait a second, I don't quite understand why that is, you know? So one of the things that Jed tries to find out in the book is what was up with the coroner report with Cookie's death, and you know, he speculates about the mafia being involved in that, which is my own fictional speculation. I'm going off track.
But there's so much here also about memory. So Jed can do the research about the long past, other things that occurred throughout his life, but also he leans a lot into, yeah, talking to his mom about things or his grandmother, but also leaning into his imagination or his memory. You know, he's really a guy that's always thinking about the past. And, you know, he's in this present moment that for him and his personal relationships and his career is very challenging. And so the other thing about this book that I really love is how funny it is in moments and how absolutely devastatingly sad it is and everything in between, and how sometimes it's sad and hilarious at the same time. There is just so much in this book to enjoy and to love and to appreciate. There's just so much. Peter Orner, thank you so much for talking to me today about The Gossip Columnist's Daughter. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me, Yvette. It's been great. And I look forward to our next Lonely Voice to be recorded ASAP.
Yes. Peter Orner is the author of The Gossip Columnist's Daughter. He's the author of 7 acclaimed books, including Esther Stories, Maggie Brown and Others, and Am I Alone Here? His work has appeared in The New Yorker, The Paris Review, The Believer, and The Best American Short Stories. He's received 4 Pushcart Prizes. He's a former Guggenheim Fellow and a recipient of the Rome Prize from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. Peter Warner is the chair of the Department of English and Creative Writing at Dartmouth College. He's also a volunteer firefighter. This has been Book Public from Texas Public Radio. Jacob Rosati composed our theme music. Dan Katz is Texas Public Radio's news director. I'm Yvette Benavides.